We're going to take your phone calls this hour with David Essel as we talk about positive thinking will never change your life, but this book will get your views. Maybe you want to share some stories, too. We've got a few more to talk about when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Dave Essel with us. David, you know our dear friend Eldon Taylor. He's a great guy.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Eldon, you know, he wrote the foreword to the book and stories in the book, George. He's amazing, isn't he?
Oh, my gosh. He sure is.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, one of the stories that he tells is in the foreword of the book, as a matter of fact, that we were talking about the law of attraction. And, you know, the premise of the law of attraction is what you think about, you attract into your life. And he said that there was this one teacher of the law of attraction, and you'll remember the story. And it was in, I believe it was in Arizona or New Mexico, that he did this motivational weekend getaway, and they did a sweat lodge, and two people died.
That's right. I remember that story.
Remember that?
Yep.
And the gentleman went to jail, and it was just a really, obviously, incredibly sad experience to hear happen. Well, another quote-unquote great teacher of the law of attraction said that the teacher who went to jail for the deaths of the two people must have attracted the deaths with his thoughts.
And he had been on our show before, too, by the way.
Oh, James Ray?
James Arthur Ray, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, James Ray was the one that this all happened to. But it's like, and that's what Eldon was saying, you know, in the foreword to my book, Eldon Taylor, he was saying, come on. You know, we take these things at point-blank value. When they're not point-blank value, it's like positive thinking is wonderful. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to share in my own life, for 20 years, George, I got up every morning and said this affirmation, and I write the full story in the book. I am David Essel, a child of God, happy, healthy, and sober, today and every day. And every night for 20 years, I drank myself to sleep. As a motivational speaker, as a coach, as a everything. And you know, I was falling victim to the thought that as long as I said the affirmation, I am losing weight, I am sober, I am making $100,000 a year, you know, that's what these books are promoting. And it's absolute nonsense. In 1996, do you remember Maharishi Mahesh Yogi?
Oh, sure do. Beatles, right?
That's right. He's the founder of Transcendental Meditation, and the Beatles, and still to this day, Paul McCartney loves Transcendental Meditation. Well, we had Maharishi on my show in 1996 to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Transcendental Meditation. At the end of the show, a couple weeks later, I'm speaking at a major event. I get off stage, and there's this woman standing there, and she said, Maharishi sent me, and I need to ask you a question. Then I need to get on a flight and go back to the university. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, I flew in to ask you one question. We sat down, and she said, Maharishi loved the interview, but he wants to know this. What do you remember from the interview? George, if I had Deepak on or Eldon Taylor or the late Wayne Dyer, who I dedicate this book to, I could tell you 10 years later what they told me. But with Maharishi, I couldn't. I said, you know what? I'm looking at her. I go, I don't have a clue. She goes, you must remember one thing. I said, he was filled with joy, a childlike joy. And she looked at me, George, and she said, David, I don't know how you're going to handle this, but the reason you remember that is because you don't have that type of joy. To which I said, the interview's over. Really nice to meet you.
Yeah, you were done, right? Right there.
I'm a national radio host. I'm an author. I live on the beach. You don't know what you're talking about. 3 weeks later, 1996, on a Tuesday at 2:30 in the afternoon, I came out of a three-day binge to alcohol and cocaine. And I looked in the mirror,
Jesus.
George, and I said, she was right. I have no joy. And I turned my life around and started teaching holistic addiction recovery because of the interview with Maharishi, who must have known there was something I was going to learn from him that I had no idea mm-hmm. was coming. So here for 20 years, George, I kept waking up saying, I'm sober, I'm a child of God, all this other kind of, you know, affirmation nonsense. But it took me going into the depths of that despair and getting help, just like we wish Prince would have, at the level that he probably needed it, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
So
good observation.
Positive thinking will not change your life unless it's a miracle. We have to do, George, that which we don't want to do.
I want one more story, then we'll take calls about the woman who lost 120 pounds in a year. How did she do that?
Oh, can we do that right now?
Yeah.
Okay. So this woman, for 30 years, she had carried 120 pounds, and she joined all the clubs, all the famous this and all the famous that, and she could not lose the weight and keep it off. She would lose 40, 50, 60 pounds, and 3 or 4 months later, it's all back. So, and she's up in the Northeast, and I said to her, listen, the conscious mind and the subconscious mind is the problem here. And George, in the book, we go into huge detail about what the difference between the conscious mind and the subconscious. The conscious mind says, I want to lose weight. The subconscious mind, until we turn it around, says, let's keep doing what we're doing. So it's a saboteur. And I said to her, if you will follow our program and surrender to what we ask you to do, I guarantee you that 12 months from now, you have lost 120 pounds, but you're going to have to resist the comfort foods, the temptation. I want you to call me. I want you to email me. I want you all over me because we're going to make this work. If we can do it for a year, your subconscious mind will be turned around. It won't sabotage you anymore, and you'll go on. That was over 15 years ago. The 120 pounds came off in 1 year, never to return.
Good job, David. You're one of a kind.
When we do what we'd rather not do, George, no matter what our listeners are facing, no matter what their goal is, we have to do what we don't want to do, and we've got to find people to hold us accountable to change.
How did you find them?
How did I find
these stories? That they come from the authors and those people?
A lot of the stories in the book are my clients.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, that I've been a counselor and a life coach for 25 years now. So a lot of the stories of people that have recovered after affairs, 120 pounds weight loss, people making $250,000 a year with high school education, and they were told their whole life they'll never make any money. These are all our clients. And then we have the Eldon Taylors and the Scarlett Lewises that wanted to write their story in the book that endorsed the work I do, but their own personal examples.
All right, let's go to the phones as they line up for you. We start by going to Jeff in Albuquerque, New Mexico, west of the Rockies. Hi, Jeff. You're up with us.
Hi, George and David. I just wanted to comment about, the topic of forgiveness, the power of forgiveness.
Sure.
I grew up in a home where my dad was alcoholic and extremely abusive to my mom and my sisters. I confronted him at one time. I think I was about 19 years old, and he was about to basically crack my skull open with a hammer. He was just flailing away. And I told him, I said, Dad, I feel like, you've done a horrible thing to this family, but at the same time, I forgive you. Wow.
And he listened to that.
And you see, I've never seen a grown man since then just crumble into tears.
Wow.
And, I didn't realize, I didn't even think how important this was until maybe 35 years later, and I keep coming back to this. And this is a story I actually share a lot with other friends of mine and even coworkers and stuff, that the power of forgiveness is just so underestimated.
Did he change after that, Jeff?
He did. As a matter of fact, he went to the VA and, was part of a group, an AA group and tried to change. And actually he did, quit drinking, although unfortunately at that point in his life he had become diabetic from the heavy drinking, and he only lived about 5 years more after that. And I just remember that I think he just needed to hear that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately my family had experienced so much pain from all his abuse that they couldn't bring themselves to it. And I think for me, because I came so late in my family, I was the fifth child and I was 9 years younger than my brother. So I kind of came in very late in the family, and never understood exactly what possessed my dad to to drink so much, and his behavior becomes so almost like Jekyll and Hyde in his manner. But I'd have to think that, you know, I was born and raised a Catholic. I think that there's something to this idea about having forgiveness and love going hand in hand. And I told him that I loved him, but I didn't like him as a person, you know, when he was drinking.
Yes.
And I know I didn't realize how much it changed me until years later in my ability to forgive other people that had done some really terrible things to me. So
good for you, Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff, that is a powerful story. And you know, and for you to be able to do it at a young age is really quite miraculous.
You know, David, I could forgive most, but there would be a couple episodes I would have a difficult time, as I mentioned. Murder of a loved one. I could forgive someone who may have been drunk and got into a car accident and killed somebody. I mean, eventually I would forgive that. Now, if it was an 8-time DUI person, I might have a different thought about that. But the one thing I would not forget and forgive is pedophilia. I would not give that person another chance.
Yes.
That's just me.
Yes. Yes. You know, George, we have these ideas, and until we go into that firestorm, I have very strong opinions of what I could and could not forgive. And then I, you know, experience someone like a Scarlett Lewis, and it at least it opens up a corner of my mind. Well, if another human can do it, maybe, I don't know, but maybe.
I'm envious of people like her.
Oh, powerful. You want to talk about strength of the human spirit. But I want to make this, you know, what Jeff was talking about is really so different and powerful in his own right, to be able to look at someone who's abusing you and say, I forgive you. Like, that's almost supernatural. That's just incredible. That's one form, and then Scarlett and what she did is another supernatural form, George. It's incredible that people can have this type of strength, this internal strength to make those decisions and then to do what needs to get done. What Jeff did required a ton of strength, and what Scarlett did and does requires a ton of strength.
Yeah. Let's go to Charles in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to the program, Charles. Go ahead.
Yes, how you doing?
Good, Charles.
I like to say, comment on something and make a statement, which I could be wrong, okay?
All right.
And, you know, I like to be corrected on this. But, okay, the kind of forgiveness that you know, he was talking about, which really sounds great, doesn't really work, in my view, and I'll explain and why I feel this way. Okay, look at the 60s. And I like to take this down to a real personal level, too, but I'll bring up there the other side here.
Okay.
Okay, look at the 60s, for example, the Civil Rights Movement. You know, if you listen to some, not all, some black leaders today, you know, they haven't really forgiven us for what has happened to what is, you know, what has happened to them, you know, hundreds of years ago. Okay, because you can have, because, okay, the reason why I say that is you have revisionist history going on in our educational system today. You can have things like Black History Month, but you can't have White History Month. You can have a whole lot of different things like, you get the point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I like to digress and talk about my personal situation here. Okay, and why I feel I haven't forgiven to a degree. Maybe I have and don't realize it, okay? And let me put it to you this way succinctly. The National Federation of the Blind is working, and I'm working with them. I am a member of it, where, and you can look this up on the internet when you get a chance. There's a thing where blind people are allowed to be paid less than the minimum wage. Okay, draw this picture in your mind if you can.
Because they're blind, I guess, right? That's their excuse.
Yes. Well, here's, you know, like, I, you know, see, I'm a victim of this
Well, that's a bunch of bull, too. You know that. You should be paid what everybody else is paid.
Right, right. And see, we're not. And these sheltered workshops, for example, they're allowed to do this. There's a section 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was, brought as a lie, stating these back in 1938, that said, for example, and that the blind were less capable of producing and being productive than sighted people, which was a lie then, and it's a lie now. In 1974, for example, I had to work for a quarter an hour. Nobody, none of your listeners has ever had to do that to my knowledge.
25 cents?
Yep.
What'd you do, live in some third world country?
Oh, yeah, this was in here in Baltimore.
Jeez.
Industries.
That's crazy.
And what I did was, instead of just saying, don't worry about it, I took it upon myself to write my delegates and to send them my pay stubs and say that blind people should be paid, that the blind trainees of blind industries should be paid the same benefits, and the stipends,
sure,
the same benefits as anybody else.
Well, did you get that changed?
Yeah, I got that changed. But if I would have just turned the other cheek, and I don't know if Jesus is really advocating here, just don't worry about it. I know God says that, vengeance is his. He will repay, which is probably true. But really, do we really live that in a world and society? No. We take it in our own hands.
All right, let's get a quick comment from David before the break. So, David, here he is. He's blind. He's getting paid 25 cents an hour. And he takes matters in his own hands, and he fights it, and he wins.
And you know what, Charles and George, and I think that's exactly what we need to do, and that would be one of the ways that we move towards forgiveness, is not by accepting it because it's the norm, but by saying, this is incorrect, this is not fair, so let me do what I can. And in that process, we can begin to let some of that angst go. You know, when I'm listening to Charles, George, and Charles, I'm sitting thinking of Helen Keller. You know, like, deaf, dumb, and blind, and she becomes a motivational speaker for my Lord's sake, and an unbelievable author. And so to say that someone who has a challenge shouldn't be paid equal to others is absolute nonsense. And Charles, good for you for standing up and fighting for what's right.
Truly remarkable how,
yes,
some people can just pick themselves up and make it happen.
I love it.
But with a minute left, so you did that flip-flop from slow down to where you are now. Are you glad you've made this change?
George, I am more than glad. You know, it has opened up my eyes to how I became a lemming. You know, the story of the lemmings, following the leaders. I became a lemming because some really big names in the world of motivation and personal growth were saying certain things were true.
Yeah.
I was following. And now my work has changed so dramatically. It has been unbelievable. The response, George, is off the wall in a positive way.
Good for you. Do you know Ben Newman at all from St. Louis? He's a motivational speaker.
No, I don't.
He works a lot with sports figures.
Okay.
And takes them into events and stuff. But I want to talk with you about that when we come back, David, if I can. Motivational speaking and how it works to really try to change people's lives. Okay, welcome back. George Norrie here with David Essel. It's our final segment here as we talk about positive thinking or the lack of. So I would guess your thoughts on this are somewhat popular in some streams and not in others?
George, that's an understatement. The people who are in my industry who, love reading motivational books and love thinking that if they think a certain way, they can attract certain stuff, they have a hard time with this concept, some of them. But what we found is some of the people, like the Eldon Taylors and Scarlett Lewis and Arielle Ford, Natalie Pace, J.J. Virgin, all of these New York Times bestselling authors who are in my industry, these are the leaders, George, and these are the ones that are jumping up and going, thank you, David, for writing this book. So I think, George, everything in life is timing. If we would have written this book 4 years ago, it would have been too soon.
But to have these leaders in my industry, in the world of personal growth and self-realization that I just mentioned, say that they want to add their story to my book tells me the time is right. So the resistance, of course there's going to be resistance, because, you know, we're saying that if you believe it, you can achieve it, isn't true. As a matter of fact, there's a story I tell in the book about one of my favorite books of all time by Napoleon Hill. Think and Grow Rich.
That's right. A huge, huge
book. I love it.
Book.
I still read it every year. And do you know, George, not one time in the book does he ever say you can think and grow rich.
Great title, though, huh?
It's a great marketing title.
Written by someone who didn't read the book.
That's right. But there's not one. Every example he gives, it's very similar to my book. Every example he gives, he talks about people battling their way with the help of others to accomplish huge goals. Our book, George, is a book of hope.
So is it unrealistic, David, to simply sit back and think positively about everything?
It's unrealistic to sit back and think positive and expect your life is going to change. It's totally unrealistic. And that's the thing that really bothered me, that years ago I used to tell people that, George. I really did. And when I said earlier in the show, this book to me is a book of amends in some way, you know, I used to tell people that whatever you believe, you can achieve. And I used to do motivational speaking 30 years ago when I started. I was on stages around the world spouting these statements that now we're saying aren't true.
All right, next up, let's go to Ray in Modesto, California on the wild card line. Hey, Ray, go ahead.
Hey, George, great show, great music tonight.
Thank you.
Hey, David, I'm not sure I completely understand your message. I haven't read your book, and just from what I'm hearing, though, you're not necessarily saying that positive thinking is not effective in as much as you're saying that positive thinking in itself is not some kind of magic that will make things happen. It has to be the starting point of what we're doing. I mean, just from a common sense point of view, positive thinking that would lead you to believe that you can do something would get you started towards that endeavor, whereas negative thinking might put you in a position where you'd never try, right?
Ray, what you're saying potentially is true. We're not saying positive thinking is bad, but we're saying it's way overrated. And you can go and read all the positive books you want, go to all the seminars you want, listen to CDs on the way. You know, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you a story. There's a guy, Dr. Bill Tollefson, who for 33 years was a psychotherapist with women who were abused. And he came and took all of the work that I did. And he went through all these courses we teach. He dropped all of his PhD work. And he came on board with starting to take these women through more challenging exercises to help them release their past and to become healthy. And he just sent, put an email on one of my YouTube videos the other day, and he said, David, your work changed my life. Enough of the positive thinking. Ray, it isn't powerful enough. It's only going to account for 20% of our success. So I'm not saying don't think positively. What I'm saying is let's drop it. It's not that powerful. I'm not drop positive thinking, but let's drop it that it's this all-healing type of a thing. It's this magic wand. And, you know, Ray, going back to a statement you made a minute ago about negative thinking, most people that come to work with us with addiction recovery come in with a really negative mindset, and I don't even try to change it. I just say, if you do the work that we're asking you to do, your mind will automatically change, and it does. Like, if you do the action steps that you'd rather not do, it's amazing how the mind starts to turn on its own. Does that make sense, Ray?
It does to me.
Yeah.
It does to me.
You know, George, and this is something when people say, well, you know, I was raised in a negative household. I have a negative attitude. Maybe it's genetic. And I'll tell you what, let's not worry about your attitude. Let's just do those things that you'd rather not. 30, 60, 90 days later, they have a spring in their step. They're accomplishing goals, and they haven't ever even tried to
That's
do
right.
this magical work.
But you'd rather be positive than negative.
Oh,
right?
My Lord, yes. But if you're not, that doesn't mean you can't be successful.
Let's go to Jim in Detroit, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hey, Jim, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George.
Hey there.
Good to talk with you.
You too. Are you you're in a hospital right now?
I'm in the hospital right now.
Are you working there or you're a patient?
I'm a patient.
What happened?
Well, April 4th, this is going to be a short story because there's a lot involved here. April 4th, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and I had a sore on my right foot, and it turned to gangrene.
Oh, my God.
And I had no idea. Well, I have neuropathy in my feet, so I have complete numbness in my feet. I came in here, the doctor emergency came in to see me April 4th, and by 6:30 in the evening, they were doing surgery on me. I've never been in the hospital before since I was born.
Oh, my God, Jim.
Right? So I get out of surgery, and he says, well, we had to take 3 toes off and part of the right of your foot. And the infection was getting worse. So they had to do another surgery on me, and they took all 5 toes off and about half of my right foot.
Oh,
I have absolutely no pain whatsoever. And I think such positive thoughts about it, but I have no issue in my head at all with losing half my foot.
Wow.
It's like I'm looking forward to walking again. I'm looking forward to driving again. It's really incredible. So they had to take me in for a 3rd surgery because there were these black lines going up my right leg. I mean, I was in big trouble. So as I'm getting ready to go into this 3rd surgery the day before, which was just the 13th of April, 3 doctors were standing at the end of the bed and they're looking at it going, oh my gosh, this is bad. We got to do surgery. And I said, you know, you guys got to do what you got to do. And he says, we may have to take your right leg off just below the knee. And I said, well, if you do, I'm going to learn to walk. I'm not going to have an issue with it. And the doctor looked at me and he says, you are the most positive patient I've ever had. And so now they got into 3rd surgery. And when I got out, I had prayed about it and meditated about it the day before and asked God to take this poison out of my system. I got into the 3rd surgery, and you know how it is. You go in there, they put you under, next thing you know, you're awake.
That's right. With whatever they did is done.
I woke up, and I said, how'd we do? And he says, best case scenario. And so now I'm going into the doctor, and he's like, oh, my gosh, you're doing good. This is incredible.
Did you keep your leg?
Yeah, I got half of my foot down there. I'm looking at it right now. It's like half the size of the other one.
And Jim, type 2 diabetes is controllable. What happened? How high was your glucose level?
407.
407?
Wow.
When I came in. Right now, they just checked it a little while ago, and it was 112.
Oh.
That's phenomenal. What are you taking for it? Metformin?
Nothing. Absolute. Well, I'm using insulin.
Yeah.
As far as pain goes, I haven't even had an aspirin yet.
Wow.
Good for you.
It's incredible. I got so many stories.
What hospital are you in? I know Detroit like the back of my hand.
St. John's at 12 Mile and Hoover.
Yep, good place.
Oh, it's these people are so professional. And it turns out I'm a gunsmith. And my doctor was a customer of mine. And I'm telling you, we get together and we talk about guns. And just
synchronicity.
How positive you are.
I think, Jim, I love your attitude. More power to you.
You got to bring Jim on some of your events sometimes, David. That's what you need.
And you know, the interesting thing is, we'll go back to Scarlett Lewis. Scarlett Lewis is the most positive, most incredible woman after what she's gone through. And so when you do the work, whatever Jim is doing, his prayer, his meditation, keep doing it for people that aren't, of course. We want you to pray and meditate and think positively, but we also want you to do the hard work.
Absolutely. You have to do the hard work.
Yeah, you do. You really do. George, do we have time for a story about...
We sure do.
...an affair?
Absolutely.
So I want to go into this relationship stuff because we had a couple come in, and this is about 10 years ago now that I write in the book, and the guy had an affair. And he moved out of his wife said, you need to move out. We've got a couple kids. You have to move out. And he came in to me to start working because he didn't know if he wanted to leave the mistress and go back to his family or go back to his family or just run like the Dickens. And, you know, he was anxious. He was nervous. He was confused. He didn't know what to do. His wife comes in. I was working with him for about a month. His wife comes in and she says, you know what? Everyone tells me to divorce him. He can't even decide if he wants me and the kids. You know, and everyone is telling me to divorce him, and everyone's telling me that he's this and he's that. And so I said, well, let's do some work. So I'm working with them individually. One day the wife comes in and she says, you know what, David? I've listened to enough of the negativity, and I am extremely negative right now.
I don't know what to do with my own decision-making skills. So I sent her home for two straight weeks with this immense amount of writing, George. She came back in and she said, I said, what would be the most difficult thing for you to do? What would be the hardest thing? She said, would be to accept my husband back into the family.
Hmm.
And I said, if that's the most difficult thing, and if you tried it, and if it worked, would it be worth it? And she looked at me and she said, it would be worth it, but there's no guarantees, are there? And I said, no. I said, you know what? More often than not in life, it's that thing that we're avoiding, it's that thing we don't want to do that's going to open the gateway to success. Do you know she came in 2 days later, George, and she sat down in front of me with the conviction like you wouldn't believe and said, David, I'm going to fight for my marriage. Her husband came in the next week and he said, I don't know what's going on. I've been really indecisive. Do you think she would take me back? I think I'm going to talk to her. I said, you know, I don't know. You guys need to talk. I worked with them for 1 year, George. Over 10 years ago, I get an email from them every Christmas. Their marriage has gotten stronger, but the only reason it did was because they were both willing to work harder than they ever had to reclaim their love. And the other thing I'm going to mention, George, and for every woman out there who's had a boyfriend or a husband that's cheated on them, they're going to hate to hear what I say next, but it's a key point of our work, is that whoever did not cheat, at some point they have to be willing to look at what role might I have played in the dysfunction of my marriage or relationship that allowed my partner, partially responsible for allowing my partner to seek help, love, sex somewhere else. And it was when that woman...
Which is not an excuse.
No, and we're not saying that, you know, that it's the woman's fault that he... But she came in and she said, David, I quit having sex with him for 6 months because I was so resentful of other things he was doing. And I see my role, instead of communicating with him, I just told him I was tired. I was told him I have the kids to take care of. I told him you work too much. I've got too much going on, and I'm not in the mood. She said I wasn't in the mood for 6 months, and that was my role.
Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, George. You know, I think the problem here is a lack of analytical thinking while we work. But too many people, they decide what you're going to do, they think positively about it, and they start working on it, but they don't analyze what they do while they're doing it so as to make it as good as it can possibly be. So a lot of people believe that just working hard will make them successful. That's the positive thinking lie.
What do you think of that, David?
You know what, Michael and George, you know, it's interesting. If you're working really hard but in the wrong direction, you're not going to create the success you want. People could put 12 hours a day into doing anything, and if it's not the right direction. And that's why, George, in the book we say this. Number one, write down what you want. Number two, write down what you're avoiding to get that. So if you want more money, you want to lose weight, you want a great relationship, you want a closer spiritual path, whatever it is that you want, what are you avoiding? You need to know what you're not willing to do or what you haven't been willing to do. The next thing is that you need an accountability partner, someone who's going to hold your feet to the fire, that's not going to take your excuses, that's not going to enable you to get away with murder. When you say, oh, I really want to double my income, or I really want to lose 100 pounds, or I really want to do this, we cannot rely on our own willpower, George, which is a big part of the book. Every success story, people relate to having someone to push them. It might be a professional coach. It might be a minister. It might be a personal trainer. It could be a best friend, but they can't be an enabler. And if we follow these, along with creating a plan, George, an action plan, 5 days a week, that from 8 at night until 9 at night, I'm going to do A, B, C, D, E, Monday through Friday, we will see a totally different existence in 12 months.
Good point. And David, give out your websites, will you?
Oh, yeah. TalkDavid.com. It's just talk, TalkDavid.com. George, all of our listeners can get chapter one for free of our new book, Positive Thinking Will Never Change Your Life, The Myth of Positive Thinking, The Reality of Success. Everyone can get chapter one at talkdavid.com, absolutely free.
That's smart, David, because once you read chapter one, you want to read chapter two.
And 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, George.
Next up, Donna in Iowa. Let's squeeze you in here, Donna. We've got about a minute or so for you. Go ahead.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just felt the need to call. I am a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober. It'll be 13 days, the 20th.
Keep going.
13 years.
13 years. 13 days is still good if you're starting, but 13
right.
years is
yeah,
great.
13 years. And I guess I wanted to agree with you when you say that positive thinking is a good start. But like you said, I had someone, it was my mother, to hold my feet to the fire. But she also gave me that helping hand up, and I just busted my butt, you know. And within a year and a half, had found myself in a home, and you know, and that fell apart. And I guess I wanted to touch on the rage part of it because I had just lost the lawsuit with the house, that was just so wrong. And when it really touched something in me when you said that you had to embrace that anger and just walk through the hell of that anger to come out the other end.
Yeah.
And I guess I just wanted to say thank you because it just kind of gave me that nudge again because it's like starting all over again.
Good for you.
Donna, go right into the teeth of the tiger, right?
You realize, David, how many people you've helped in your career?
Thank you. You know, over 30 years, it's been remarkable. And you know, I'm now on such a path with this new understanding, something much greater. I understand life at a much deeper level than I did. And we know that getting the collaborators, people like you too, George, that help us with this message is going to touch so many more people.
Indeed. David, you take care of yourself. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday night, okay?
Yes. Thank you, George.
David Essel. Up next, we're going to talk about the electric universe with David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill. Both of them have been on the program with me before, and we've got them together when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And here's our final emerging artist. Lieutenant Daniel Hyde died in March of 2009 in Iraq. He was 24 years old. He's from Modesto, California. The artist is Night and Fog. The song is called First Lieutenant Daniel Hyde. And Night and Fog from Oakland, California.